We've enjoyed our time here. We started talking about the age of the Earth yesterday, and then we talked about comets, how comets glorify God in their brilliance. And then we talked about Adam and Eve. Were Adam and Eve real people? This morning we talked about the design in nature, the precision of the solar system, and then the God of creation in the morning service. And we're going to end here with the moon. And I like the moon. I wish there wasn't clouds tonight so you could actually see the moon. It's close to a full moon tonight. And I always like to talk about the moon when the moon's out there. But it's up there. You just have to believe by faith that it's up there where you can see it. Now, you may have some questions you didn't get to ask during the sessions we've had. So hold those. I think we'll have some time to answer questions after we're done with the moon. So make sure you have those ready for me, and we'll try to get to as many of those as possible. So I call this the moon, a signpost from God. So we find out about the moon in Genesis chapter 1, starting in verse 14. And God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, for days and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. So our topic this evening is that lesser light mentioned in verse 16, our moon, the same moon that Adam and Eve looked at, a quarter of a million miles away, or mere light seconds if you prefer, a quarter the size of the earth compared to the basketball size of the earth compared to the baseball size of the moon. So where did the moon come from? Well, Genesis tells us directly about the origin of the moon. But did you know the origin of the moon and the moon up there in the sky is one of the strongest evidences for understanding that it was created? Now, for those who don't believe the Bible, many careers and many dollars have been spent trying to figure out where the moon came from. And we still don't really have a good scientific explanation for the moon. You think being so close that we would, but we don't. So when I was at Haddon Township High School in grade 8, grade 7, I still remember grade 7 because my history teacher was crying in the hallway, and she came in and told us that President Kennedy had been assassinated. So it gives you an idea of my age. But in grade 8, we studied earth science, and my textbook in the public school there told us how the moon came about, and they told us it was the fission theory. That is, the earth was a big blob of molten lava, and it was spinning fast enough that the moon came out. And I wish I had that book, but I remember the picture in my eighth grade earth science book showed the moon coming out of the earth where the Pacific Ocean is today. That's how the Pacific Ocean formed. I don't know if you knew that or not. But there's a problem with that theory. The first problem is that the Earth would have to be spinning 10 times faster than it is now for that to be true. So you think you have trouble getting your work done now, 24 hours? What if a day was 2.5 hours? That would be difficult, wouldn't it? And then we have a trouble with the moon coming out. We have something called the Roche limit. Okay, that's the breakup limit. So we got these tidal forces. We talked about the tidal forces this morning on the Earth that gives us the water tides and makes rocks grind against each other and so forth. But there's also tidal forces on the moon. And if the moon is close enough within the Roche limit, the tidal forces are so great, the difference between the front and the back of the moon, it would just rip it apart and you'd get a ring. Okay? And obviously, we don't have a ring, we have a moon. So that was a problem. And then, of course, we're talking about the 1960s, we went to the moon. And we got some rocks and things. And we found out that moon rocks are made differently than Earth rocks. The moon doesn't have much iron, and the earth has lots of iron. And so they kind of gave up on that. That's the nice thing about science. When they can't figure it out, then they go on to the next theory. So the next theory after that, that doesn't keep them from lying to eighth graders, but next theory was the capture theory. So the moon is sort of wandering out there in space, and somehow it inserts itself into almost a perfectly circular orbit around the Earth. Now, when I was a teenager, we didn't have video games. I know you teenagers are saying, how's it possible you could have survived without video games? But at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, they had a proto-video game. And so I'd hop on the high-speed line, I guess you call it PATCO these days, I'd hop on the high-speed line and go into Philadelphia. I don't know where my parents thought I was, but I was in Philadelphia going to the Franklin Institute, and they had a proto-video game where you're trying to get a rocket ship to insert itself into an orbit around a planet. And you had to get the speed right and the angle right and so forth. And I tried and I tried and I tried and never could get it to work. Every time I did it, my rocket ship would go, you know, out into outer space somewhere. And so that impressed upon me as a young teenager how hard it would be to get a moon to insert itself into an almost perfectly circular orbit around the planet. And nobody else could believe it either. So they gave up that theory. It's gone. Okay. Next theory they came up with, this is all during my lifetime, was the condensation theory. Oops. I don't know what happened there. Condensation theory. So the idea is you have gases and dust, and they're spinning around, and gravity pulls them together, and it forms the Earth and forms the moon. Trouble with that is that nobody could figure out why you got two things, why you just didn't get one bigger thing, you know, Earth and the moon combined. Nobody could get that straight. Well, there's kind of a revival with the condensation theory. They call it the synesia theory. If you go online, look at the synesia theory. They're trying to make that work. And what they've done is they put all the information about the Earth and the Moon in there and how they think they form and try to get the computer to figure out how it could have happened. And in the synesia theory, the Moon forms first and then the Earth. That's kind of an interesting thing. But it still doesn't work out. The chemical elements are not right, like magnesium's wrong and that type of thing. So they still don't have it worked out, but they're working on trying to get that to work, the condensation theory. But if you go online and say, where did the moon come from? Or if you go to any public school in this state, what you'll be taught is this, the collision theory. So if you go to a NASA website, this is what they teach. So they have, just like they had a picture in my book about the fusion theory or fission theory, now they have pictures of the collision theory in people's textbooks. And so what you have is a small planet, about the same size as Mars, and they gave it a name. It's called Theia. And it runs into the Earth, and all this debris is thrown up, and from that debris, you get the moon. And the trouble is, some of you will understand this, but we talk about, in physics, we talk about turning energy. We call that angular momentum. Angular momentum is conserved, and so forth. Anyway, it doesn't work out. It doesn't even work out on computers. I call this the big whack, and a whack, all right? But in order for the angular momentum to work out, to get the turning energy right, you had to have at least two whacks. You had to have a whack from this side and a whack from that side to get the collision theory to work out. And then you have a problem, the fact that the moon is moving away from the Earth. Did you know that? The moon is moving away from the Earth at a speed of about 2.5 inches each year. So every year, the moon is 2.5 inches further from us than it was. Now, that's not a problem if you're like me. You believe that the Earth and the moon are only 6,000 or 7,000 years old. But if you believe the Earth and moon system is 4.6 billion years old, then you got a problem. Okay? Even a billion years, that puts the moon back right next to the Earth. Okay? And guess what? It's beneath the Roche limit, and it gets torn apart, you get a ring. You don't get a moon anymore. Not to mention the fact you'd have a real problem if the moon was real close to the Earth, because like we talked about this morning, the tides would overflow the land twice a day, and that makes it difficult to live on land like that when that takes place. And so this is the best theory they have. This is what they teach in schools, but the thing I have a problem with is they know it doesn't work. Only the scientists will admit that, but it's in all the textbooks. There's something fundamentally dishonest about teaching children a theory that they know doesn't work. I can understand saying this is our best guess, but they said this is true, and yet they themselves know it doesn't work. That's why they're working on this synesthesia theory to get something to work. So here we have the moon is the closest heavenly body to us, and it is very close to us compared to any other heavenly body, yet we don't have any scientific explanation for where it came from. Now, some secular people, the people who don't believe the Bible, they also see the problem as well. And so what do they do? What if you don't believe the Bible, but you know the science doesn't work either? Where does the moon come from? Well, that's the next idea, and that's the artificial moon theory. So they believe the moon's kind of like the Death Star, okay? That aliens built the moon. So there's this book, and there's other books. You can go on YouTube and see this wacko theory thing. But they believe that aliens built the moon. And once we get smart enough to figure out the moon is not a natural object, then the aliens are going to come back. And they're going to invite us to join their parliament or Congress or whatever aliens have, okay? I don't know if they'll have trouble electing a new Speaker of the House for their parliament or whatever. Anyway, so that's what's going to happen. They're going to invite us to join up with them and so forth. Now, why would they believe that it's artificial? Well, there's a lot of funny things about the moon. And this, you could read the whole book if you'd like. But their biggest point is this. I call it God's signature in the sky. So we had a total eclipse down in South Carolina. I think it was back in 2017. We had a big thing on campus about it. And what you notice is the moon and the Earth are the same size in the sky. This is remarkable. Excuse me, the sun. The sun and the moon, thank you. The sun and the moon, see, she helps me. The sun and the moon are the same size in the sky. This is remarkable because the sun is 400 times further from us than the moon is. But on the other hand, the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, so they look the same in the sky. It's only from the surface of this planet they look the same. And there's no other planet. We don't know of any other planet in this solar system or any other solar system where the sun of that planet and the moon of the planet would be the same size in the sky. In fact, because we know the moon's moving, it's only at this particular time in evolutionary history that the moon and the sun are the same size in the sky. Isaac Asimov was a biochemist and a prolific science fiction writer, also president of the Humanist Society. He said that if it wasn't a coincidence, it would be the greatest proof of God's creation. Of course, it's a coincidence, right? No, it's God. It's like God signed it and said, I did this. There's no other explanation for why the moon and the sun are the same size in the sky. And so these guys who believe the aliens built it, they've grabbed hold of that. They say this can't be a coincidence. It has to be aliens that did it. So even though the moon's close to us, 100 million times closer to us than the nearest star, secular scientists still don't have a convincing scientific theory of where it came from. Bible-believing Christians have a better idea. God created the moon on the fourth day of creation and placed it in a circular orbit to accomplish his particular purposes, one of which is to bring him glory and praise. So that brings us to the question, why did God create the moon? What's it up there for? Would we miss it if it were gone? And the Bible gives us important information about the Creator's purposes for the moon. So one of the things in Jeremiah 31:35, it says, thus saith the Lord, which giveth the moon for a light by night. So he made it to be nightlight, okay, among other things. So what else? Well, Deuteronomy 33:14, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the moon. Now, I understand. Now, my name, George, means farmer, but I'm far from a farmer. As you've heard, I grew up just a block away from the high-speed line. When I was, I forget how old, like 12 years old, my school took a field trip to a farm so I could see a cow. I'd never seen a cow close up before. I'd seen them from the road, but I never saw them. I thought the milk came in those bottles, they used to those big glass bottles they used to deliver at the house. I'd never seen a cow. So I'm not a farmer. But I understand that the sun makes crops grow. But what does the moon do? Well, as I go around and talk to people, I talk to farmers, even farmers in Australia, they all assure me that the moon has something to do with their crops. I have looked up and saw some scientific articles about the effect of the moon on the crude protein content in rye grains and so forth. But I don't really know how it works. But farmers assure me that there is something there. And let me recommend this to you. Sometimes the science hasn't caught up to the Bible. Okay, so if you find something where it looks like science and the Bible disagree with each other, it's probably because science is not advanced enough. Obviously, the creator of the universe, he knows all these things. And so he says that there's a relationship between growing things and the moon. He knows how it works, and we just haven't figured it out yet, okay? So give, you know, Martin Luther said something I thought was interesting. He said, give God the honor of being smarter than you are. Okay? And I think that's good advice. So if you come across something in the Bible you don't understand, you don't throw the Bible away. You say, God is smarter than I am. God is more advanced than our current state of science. Well, people always want to know, does the moon affect human behavior? So Psalm 121:6 says, the sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. Now, I understand about the sun smiting you by day because of my hairstyle. I got that. I have to wear a hat, okay? But how does the moon smite somebody? How does that work? And there's another verse. What did I do? I killed it. There it is. And Jesus' fame went throughout all Syria, and they brought unto him those which were lunatic. The word lunatic is actually from a Greek word that means sun-smitten or sun-stroked or something like that, and he healed them, okay? And now sometimes you look at modern translations, and they'll translate that word epileptic. But there's nothing in the Greek that means epileptic, okay? They're just trying to figure out what it means. They don't understand that. So we don't understand how the moon affects people's behavior. But again, as I go around, and even today, this morning, somebody was telling me, if you work in a mental institution, or you work with the handicapped, or you work in a prison, or you work in a, you know, you're a police officer or teacher and so forth, and I say, does the phase of the moon have any effect on your students? They say, oh yeah, you know, when it's a full moon out, we got to get more officers on or whatever. So everybody tells me that there's an effect of the moon. How does that work? I don't know. We used to go to Australia. We would go to a place called Ingham, and there was this Brother Wally Jaworski's church there, and they had a crazy man in the church. In fact, we found that most fundamental churches have at least one crazy person in them. Okay. I said that in San Francisco and Pastor Ennis's church, and a guy in the back row, he said, that's me! He said, and everybody turned around and said, that's him! You know, and he made a living begging on street corners, and interesting fellow. But I think it's wonderful that people with mental illness actually feel loved at Bible-believing churches. That's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But anyway, this guy at Brother Jaworski's church was named John, and we got to know him over a period of years. And sometimes he'd have to do time at the local mental hospital. So I went to visit him. I said, John, how did you sleep last night? He said, oh, it was terrible. It was a full moon. He said, all the other You know, people here, they were rattling the bars and climbing the walls and howling like wolves and that type of thing. So I couldn't get a wink of sleep. And so even this crazy person knew that the moon affected their behavior, but we just don't know how it works. Again, give God the honor of being smarter than you are. Ancient people used the moon to tell time. This is the Antikythera mechanism. We found it at the bottom of the Mediterranean, Aegean Sea, and it's over 2,000 years old. And we'd have a tough time building one of these today. It's an analog computer, and it actually shows where all the planets they could see in that time, and the moon, and so forth. And they had a mechanism, and they could actually tell where everything was in the heavens based on this analog computer. So in case you think that ancient people were stupid, okay, see if you can build one of these things. Ancient people used the moon instead of a calendar. We know the month is based roughly on the moon, lunar cycle. Before compasses were invented, the moon was used to tell direction. Okay, they could look at the moon, they could tell north, south, east, and west. We've lost that ability a lot of times. And the moon gives us the seasons. We talked a little bit about this, about the tilt of the moon. So Psalm 104:19, he appointed the moon for seasons. So what gives us seasons? As we mentioned earlier, it's the tilt of the earth, the 23.5 degree tilt of the earth. And that tilt is stabilized by the moon. The moon has a really unusual orbit. Most moons circle their planets in the equatorial region, the fattest part, okay? Our moon is in the ecliptic. If you remember back here, 10th grade geometry, a plane is defined by three points. So the three points are the sun, the moon, and the earth. That's the ecliptic, okay? So the moon's in this ecliptic orbit. Because it's in the ecliptic orbit, it stabilizes the tilt of the earth and gives us stable seasons. As I mentioned this morning, you know, Mars doesn't have a moon like we have, and so its tilt varies from 0 to 60 degrees. Okay, can't live on a planet like that. So how did the psalmist know that the moon gives us seasons? Okay, I mean, we only figured that out in the modern scientific era. Okay, that's really pretty good, isn't it? So here's a picture of the Earth and the moon like you've never seen it. So this is taken by a satellite, NASA satellite, that's a million miles closer to the Earth, to the sun, than we are. And it's looking back as the moon crosses in front of the Earth. I've marked where the North Pole is there so you can kind of see the tilt. Okay? And what really impresses you there is that how dark the moon looks. You see that? The moon has a reflectivity approximately the same as the asphalt in your parking lot. Okay? It's very dark. Now, we don't see it that way because usually we see the moon against the blackness of outer space. But here you're looking at it with the light of the Earth behind it. And so you can see how dark the moon really is. And what we find is that the moon was any brighter than this, it would throw, you know, there's a lot of animals that take their biological clues from the light of the sun and the moon and so forth. The moon would be too bright. It would throw off all the biological rhythms and so forth. So there's a reason why God made the moon dark like he did. He had a purpose for life, so life could exist on this planet. We also see that God created the moon to glorify himself. Psalm 148 and verse 3. It says, praise ye him, sun and moon, praise him, all ye stars of light. Now, I heard you praise the Lord. I heard the orchestra praise the Lord, and with music, and with your singing and so forth. But you may have noticed that the man in the moon doesn't have a mouth. Okay, so how does the moon praise God? Well, the moon praises God by doing what was created to do. Okay, by the way, that's how we do as well. Okay. So think about it. So the moon gives us the tides. The tides go up and down twice a day. And because of the tides, we get ocean currents. And the ocean currents bring the dead organic matter on the bottom of the ocean, bring it to the top of the ocean, and then green organisms like algae eat it. So at least half of the oxygen you're breathing comes from those green organisms in the ocean. I know most people think that it's from the Brazilian rainforest, but it's not. It's the ocean, okay? So if the moon didn't do its job, if there were no tides and no currents, no upwelling, no green organisms in the ocean, no oxygen, you all die. Okay. Lord praise, the moon praises God by keeping you alive. That's pretty good, isn't it? By the way, all of us have gifts. I kind of intimated this morning, but all of us have gifts that other people don't have. And we're supposed to use those gifts to serve God, serve the people of our assembly, our community, and so forth. Just think how wonderful this place would be if everybody in this room did whatever it is that you do better than anybody else. Okay? I have this science thing, okay? So I try to use my science thing to serve the Lord. My wife has an organizational thing. That's why she keeps us going in the right direction, and she uses her organizational thing to serve the Lord. And you all have something that you do that nobody else in this church does as well, that you can do that will be a great blessing to this congregation and to the community as a whole. So let's learn from the moon about that, all right? Let's do whatever it is that we can do. And we see that the moon is beautiful. Think about that. This is a hallmark of God's creative style. Not only does he have all this engineering going on here, but he makes it nice to look at. Think about the silvery shell of the moon reflected on the surface of the water and so forth. It's beautiful. Song of Solomon. Solomon is talking about his first wife here. And he tells us about the beauty of the moon. He said, "Who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners?" Now, that terrible as an army with banners thing doesn't work well on Valentine's cards, okay? But you have to understand what he's talking about. He's looking at this as the stars marching across the heavens like soldiers with the gleaming helmets going, you know, into battle array against the enemy. He understood about warfare, and so he's thinking that's a beautiful sight as well, okay? But I think about that song that we sang this morning. Here's another verse about 1 Corinthians. Talks about there's one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, another glory of the stars. One star differs from another star in glory. Okay, so we have a certain glory. And I think about this song that we sang this morning. Fair is the sunshine, fair still the moonlight, and all this twinkling starry host. Jesus shines brighter, Jesus shines purer than all the angels heaven can boast. So when I talk about Jesus Christ being more beautiful than the moon, does something in your heart resonate to that? Do you say, yes, that's right? Or do you say, what is he talking about? What's he saying? And so forth. Well, there's plenty of people here who'd love to tell you why we believe Jesus Christ is more beautiful than the moon. It has to do with the gospel, okay? And you can find out more about that from a number of people here at this church, that the moon is beautiful. Well, we also see the moon as a reminder of God's enduring promises. It talks about in Psalm 72:5, "They shall fear thee," speaking of Solomon as a type of Christ, "as long as the sun and moon endure throughout all generations." Or Psalm 89:37, "It," the throne of David, "shall be established forever as the moon, as a faithful witness in the heavens." Or Jeremiah 31:36, "If those ordinances," that's talking about the ordinances of the sun and moon, "depart from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel shall also cease from being a nation before me forever." So think about all the ancient nations you study in the Bible. So where are the Edomites? Where are the Ammonites? Where are the Hittites? Where are the Philistines? We dug up some Philistines and we extracted their DNA. And guess what? There's nobody here that's related to Philistines. I mean, you may eat like a Philistine, but that's a whole other matter, okay? So there are no Philistines here today. That genetic heritage is completely gone, okay? Nobody related to Philistines, okay? And that goes on through time. We're narrowing down the genetic material of the human race. We talked about that yesterday when we talked about Adam and Eve. So Where are all those ancient people? What of the ancient nations exists today? One. Israel. Okay. How do I know that Israel exists today? Because I can go outside and look at the moon. As long as the moon's in the sky, Israel's going to continue to exist. Promised by God. Closed case. You know, it talks about the moon in the new heavens and new earth. I'm not a theologian, and so you can correct me on this later, but it looks like this to me. It looks like, as for the new heavens and new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. So it looks like there's not only going to be a new heavens and new earth, there's going to be a new moon as well. Not like our new moons that are dark, but a real new moon. And so it looks like the moon, some kind of moon, is going to exist in the new heavens and new earth. We also find that the moon is used as a sign of coming calamity. A lot of verses about this in the Bible. It talks about there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Any perplexity today? Any countries on the earth where there's perplexity? Well, everywhere, right? Where is there a country? Where is there a people on earth that there's just peace and happiness and calm and so forth? As we get closer to the end of the age, the sea and the waves are roaring, speaking of the political upheaval that we experience. And so we're going to see signs in the sun and in the moon in days to come as the Lord tarries. And it also speaks of the glories of the millennial kingdom. It says, moreover, the sun, light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun. The light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days in the day that the Lord bindeth up the breach of his people and healeth the stroke of their wound. So the idea of the seven here is perfection. We're not really thinking literally about the sun being, you know, seven times brighter, the moon being seven times brighter. We're talking about the glorious future that awaits those of us who love him and will be in his kingdom in that day, in that millennial kingdom. I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to that day when we will rule and reign with Christ. We get in a lot of Christian schools, and the young people are all concerned about what they're going to do for a living. Okay, what are they going to major in college? And I say to them, well, let's think a little bit beyond that. What are you going to do after you die? Well, if you're a Christian, your real occupation is ruling and reigning with Christ. So how are you preparing for that? You know, take your eyes off of this and look up here. Look up in the heavens a little bit. Well, here's a picture of the aurora borealis, northern lights, and the moon. Years ago, we took mission teams to Nova Scotia, and my little daughters were 2 and 3 years old, and my two-year-old was playing on the ground, and there was this beautiful aurora in the sky in Nova Scotia. And my coworker, Nelson McGue, who is with the Lord today, I still remember he picked her up off the ground, said, look at the beautiful colors in the sky. But she had been playing with a stick on the ground, and she said, stick, stick. She wanted that stick. And she wouldn't look up. She refused to look up. She's a pastor's wife in Australia now, so don't worry about her, okay? And that's the way we are. Here the Lord wants to show us this glorious future he has planned for us in his millennial kingdom and a new heavens and a new earth. And he's put the moon up as a symbol, as a sign to remind us that that's still in our future. So as long as the moon's still there, that future is still yours if you're a child of Christ. And what do? We look down. Spend a lot of time looking at these things, okay? Right? We're looking down. We should be looking up. So next time when it's no cloud in the sky, look up, look at the moon, and remember the glorious future that God has planned for all of those who love the Lord Jesus Christ. Hopefully that'll be an encouragement to you. Okay, what questions do you have about this or about anything else we talked about these last couple days? Any questions that you have? Yes, sir. Okay, what is the aurora borealis? So we talked yesterday about how we have the magnetic field of the Earth that protects the Earth from charged particles from outer space. And so it directs those charged particles toward the poles, to the North Pole and to the South Pole. So the ones in the North Pole, that's the aurora borealis. It actually, those charged particles hit molecules of nitrogen and oxygen and rip the electrons off of them and cause them to glow. So it's actually molecules having their electrons ripped off. And that's what gives us that glow in space. They do. They have the aurora australis, I guess is how you pronounce it. So there's a South Pole. But there's not as many people living in the south, toward, in the south part of the hemisphere compared to the northern hemisphere. So we get to see more of that. So in 1859, there was what's called the Carrington event. You can look it up online. And there was a coronal mass discharge of the sun. We would say in common parlance, the sun burped. And a piece of the sun came and hit the Earth directly in 1859. Now, in 1859, all they had was telegraph. So the telegraph paper caught on fire. The telegraph keys started vibrating on their own. And they were getting aurora down in Havana, Cuba. Mexico City, they saw aurora in 1859. Now, if that happened again in our modern day, we have, you know, with our grid and our transformers and so forth, the estimate is that we would lose power for 2 years. So we were in Virginia someplace, and I met a guy, and that was his line of work. He worked with those big transformers for the power company. And I said, is that right? He said, yeah, that's right. He said, there's so few of those transformers. You remember just recently some people destroyed some of those transformers in North Carolina and I think Washington State, they've done that. And because there's so few of them, they only have a couple on hand as spares. And he said, that's right, it would take 2 full years to get the grid back up. Okay, so think about doing without electricity for a couple years. Okay, so that could happen at any time. Think how our world would change. Okay, so that's something to think about. So the aurora would be pretty, but not having electricity for 2 years, that would be a problem. Any other questions? Stunned. I've stunned you into silence. Okay. Going once? Going twice? Yes?
The places that experience the borealis, do they experience electrical surges as they're above in the atmosphere?
So the good thing about those places is that nobody lives there. Okay? So all the charged particles ride down right to the North Pole, and nobody lives at the North Pole. There is a problem. There are people living at the South Pole for research purposes. They get a pretty good dose of radiation, and it causes higher levels of cancer. Okay, and it can also wipe out their electronics. So I was reading a story about some researcher that had to have their appendicitis, and they couldn't radio their base because one of these events was going on, and so they couldn't get them out of there. So they had to perform the appendectomy right there, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, pretty tough stuff. One of the problems we're facing is that the Earth's magnetic field is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. We talked about that yesterday. And so it wouldn't take a Carrington event to wipe out our electrical grid. It could be something less than that today because our protective shield that God has placed over the Earth is weaker than it was back in the 19th century. And so people are concerned about that. I think we mentioned yesterday about how we have the Southern Atlantic anomaly right off the coast of Brazil. And when the satellites go over that spot, they have to turn them off so their electronics won't get fried by the charged particles in outer space. So it's already becoming a problem. Also, we find that the North Pole is moving. And not only is it moving, it's going faster and faster and faster. It's moving towards Siberia. South Pole is moving as well. It's actually left Antarctica. It's actually in the water between Antarctica and Australia. I'm talking about the magnetic poles, you understand, okay? So it's interesting, the North Pole and the South Pole are actually headed toward each other. At the current rate of movement and so forth, they'd meet in Indonesia somewhere. Well, that's not going to happen, all right? The North Pole and South Pole are not going to be in the same place. So some scientists think that what's going to happen is that the poles are going to flip. And we've seen evidence that they've done that in the past, especially probably during the flood, the poles flip. And North Pole becomes South Pole becomes North Pole. For a while, we lose, you know, the shields, you know, Scotty, you know, raise, you know, lower the shields, Scotty, or whatever. The shields are, you know, they're gone. And so we would expect that the cancer rate would go up at a time like that. I'm interested in the fact in Revelation, it talks about the kings of the earth hiding themselves in the caves, in the ground. And I wonder if it's because they lost their magnetic shield during the tribulation period, and that's the only safe place to be is underground. That's just a thought. Yes? So the crater in New Mexico, how many of you have seen that crater? I've seen it, but it's just a you know, asteroid that hit and made that hole there. Okay. When did it happen? Well, we know it happened after the flood because it's all flood sediment that's there. So it happened sometime after the flood. So, you know, there's things on the earth that we can't see very well. You know, people often ask me, where did the Grand Canyon come from? And why aren't there other Grand Canyons? And the interesting thing is there are. We found Grand Canyons similar to our Grand Canyon in the South. We found one under the ice in Greenland, and there's one in Antarctica. So there's actually three Grand Canyons on the earth that are about the same size. So it's just we haven't been able to see them because of all the ice on top of them. So that's kind of an interesting thing. So if that ice melted, we'd probably find more evidence of craters and that type of thing from asteroid impacts. Yes? Yes. So the question is about global warming or climate change and what effect do people have on it. So if you're thinking about global warming from a Christian perspective, a biblical perspective, you have the flood. Okay, that was certainly a climate change going on there. And so you have the flood, you have a lot of warm water and a lot of cold air because you'll have a lot of volcanic activity after the flood. So you have cold air, warm water, a lot of evaporation, and you get these terrible snowstorms. And those terrible snowstorms build up in the middle of the continents, and then the glaciers move from the middle of the continents to where the water's warm, and that's what we see. We see the scratches on the rock. We see the glaciers forming in the middle of Asia, even in Australia and other continents, and then they go toward where the water is. And then after about 500 or 600 years, the water cools down to what it is like today, and the ice age is over. So the ice age is evidence of the flood. You can't have an ice age without the flood. Well, what would we expect as Christians? We'd expect that things would be warming up since the ice age. And that's what we see. A general trend has been to a warmer earth. Now, your question is a harder one. Your question is, how much of that warming is because of man's activities? And the answer is, I don't know. I would be willing to expect that some of it would be, but our scientific tools, our computer algorithms and so forth, are not advanced enough to be able to answer that question. Plus, a lot of warming comes from the sun, what the sun's doing. We don't know how the sun works. We have this 11-year cycle of the sun, and we don't know how it works. And so we found that we can look at the sun. We can measure the sunspots. Back in the late 1680s, there's something called the Mohner minimum, where the number of sunspots just about disappeared, and you had what we call the Little Ice Age, and it was a terrible time. The Thames froze over, the crops failed, people starved. Okay, and what we see in the sun today is similar to that time. There's some scientists who think that we're actually going into another minimum. And so that'd be interesting if for next generation that we had colder than normal temperatures. Some people think it's already begun. Some people think it'll begin in the 2030s. I don't know. So you got to consider about what the sun is doing as well. So it's a very complex situation. So I call myself a global warming agnostic. I'm the first agnostic to speak in this pulpit, probably, okay? Because I don't think the tools of science can answer your question. I think it's too hard of a question. Yeah, so you look at Antarctica and Greenland. How do you build up those big ice sheets? Antarctica is the driest continent on Earth. It's drier than Sahara Desert. So how do you get miles of ice in Antarctica that are still here today? Well, it's because of the ice age. And what we'd expect? We'd expect it to be melting. They're concerned about the Western Antarctic ice sheet going slipping off into the ocean and raising the water levels. Some say, you know, like 10 meters or something. Well, 10 meters, I mean, goodbye New York City. That's it, right? And a lot of major cities in the world. So could that happen? And the answer, yeah, it could happen. And maybe it's going to happen during the tribulation period. I don't know. But there's a lot of changes in the future, a lot of things that are primed to happen that haven't happened yet that could happen in Revelation. If you want a global warming, go to the book of Revelation. A lot of global warming in the book of Revelation, okay? Oh, yeah. The reason why it could slip off, my wife's reminding me, is because there's more than 100 volcanoes under the Western Antarctic ice sheet, and it keeps it all warm and liquidy under there. And so it's not solid, so it could easily slip off into the ocean. And the sea levels could rise very rapidly in a case like that. Okay, well, I think I've worn out my welcome. But thank you so much. If you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer those after the service. Had a wonderful time here. Enjoyed getting to know you. And let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll turn it back over. Father, we thank you for what we've learned about your created object, the moon, and how the moon glorifies you. And Lord, we think about that glorious future for all those of us who know and love you. And Lord, help us to take heart. Help us to be encouraged every time we look at the moon and know what you have planned for us. For Jesus' sake, we pray.